VOA, the science edition of Press Conference USA. Here's your host, Rick Pantaleo.
Welcome to the science edition of Press Conference USA on the Voice of America. Have you ever gazed up at the night sky and wondered if planets like our own Earth exist among the billions and billions of stars in the universe? Modern humans have been perplexed about the answer to that question since about the time they began walking the Earth some 200,000 years ago. Think about this. It is thought that our own Milky Way galaxy has about 100 million stars, which may be the average number of stars held by each of the 100 billion galaxies some scientists think exists in our observable universe. That means there may be more than 10 quintillion stars in all, with perhaps an average of at least one Earth-like planet circling it. As technology's improved over the years, and especially when NASA's planet-hunting Kepler Space Telescope was made operational in May 2009, astronomers have discovered more than 5,000 planets orbiting stars beyond our own solar system. Of those discovered, NASA says that nearly 2,000 of these extrasolar or exoplanets have been confirmed. Today, we're going to learn about these worlds and the search for more that exist beyond our solar system, and if there's a possibility of finding one that can host intelligent life. My first guest today is Eric Ford. He's a professor with the Department of Astronomy and Astrophysics and the Center for Exoplanets and Habitable Worlds at Penn State University in State College, Pennsylvania. Eric, of course, my first question is, what is an exoplanet?
An exoplanet is a planet beyond our solar system. So for hundreds of years, we've studied the eight planets in our own solar system, and we learned a lot about them. But only recently have we begun to discover planets around other stars. And as we do, we learn that nature makes a much richer variety of planets than we find in our own solar system. So we like to observe them, characterize them, and try to learn as much as we can to find out the whole richness of nature.
If you were to make a wild guess, a guesstimate, how many planets do you think are beyond the solar system we live in?
Well, maybe let's confine it to our galaxy. So the solar system orbits the sun. The star is one of about 300 billion stars in our galaxy. We now believe that the typical star in our galaxy has at least one planet. So I would guess that there's at least 300 billion and probably over a trillion planets in our own galaxy alone. The universe will have hundreds of billions of galaxies, at least is what we can see of it. And so the true number of planets is just astronomical.
I can remember reading about Galileo looking at planets in his brand new telescope. So I can see how planets within our own solar system could be discovered and detected. How are exoplanets detected?
The most obvious way of looking at them, like Galileo did, say, to see the moons of Jupiter, is actually a very small fraction of the planets we know around other stars. Only recently has that method begun to really pay off, and it's poised to do great things. But at the moment, most of the over 1,600 planets that we've discovered around other stars come from one of two techniques. In one method, we watch the star and measure how bright it is and wait for a planet to pass in front of the star and cast a small little shadow over the Earth.
That's the transiting system?
That's right. So we use transits to refer to when a planet passes in front of its star and causes the observed brightness of the star to decrease every time the planet passes in front of its star. And that's the method that's gained a lot of attention through NASA's Kepler mission, as well as ground-based surveys and the Crow mission as well. But really, the Kepler mission really blew the lid off that one. And now there's thousands of planet candidates that have been identified by Kepler, and most of them are real. There's still a lot of work to be done. Even though we've found these objects that are interesting, there's still thousands of them that we've yet to conduct the additional observations and analysis that will be necessary to turn those into planets that we are really confident must be planets.
When was the first exoplanet discovered, and how far away is it?
Sort of first planets that were widely recognized as exoplanets were in 1993. Penn State's Alex Wolfskins discovered them around a pulsar, so a star that contains a bunch of neutrons and is spinning really fast and has a beam of radiation pass in front of the Earth every few milliseconds. That's sort of one of these other techniques that have found planets, but hasn't found as many. It was sort of a really weird object. So at first, people were sort of shocked and surprised. And even though it should have told us that planet formation was really robust, it was kind of confusing at the time. Then in 1995, astronomers found the first planet around a sun-like star that was clearly identified as such. And then after that, it really took off, because that method of measuring the motion of the star towards and away from the Earth by measuring the Doppler shift, the tendency for the spectrum to appear a little bit redder or bluer as the star moves towards or away from you, that method has found hundreds of planets since then, and that really led to a lot of progress for the field.
I take it since the discovery was made back in 1993, that's way before Kepler, correct?
Indeed, right. So Kepler mission launched in 2009, and so it really transformed the field, because most of the planets that had been known up to then were significantly larger than the Earth. Because that's what these other methods and the telescopes at the time were able to detect. And as we've improved technology and been able to observe for longer and longer, we've gone from being able to just finding Jupiter planets that are very close to their stars to now finding both Jupiter-like planets that orbit at Jupiter-like distances, but also finding Earth size and even planets as small as Mars and Mercury around some stars. So we're making a lot of progress in the types of planets that we can discover.
Most of these discoveries, I take it, were made by professional astronomers?
A lot of this is hard work. You sort of hear about the headline when there's a press release, but oftentimes years of work went into that. The Kepler mission, even though only launched in 2009, people have been thinking about it since the 70s and proposing it over and over each time, improving the design a little bit until it was finally selected by NASA to go forward. So oftentimes science, you know, makes gradual progress slowly, and you sort of get to see the sort of exciting little tidbit at the end. So in the case of you know, the Kepler mission, it was really a transformation we were able to detect. But even before then, we found a lot of interesting planets from the radial velocity technique and from ground-based missions as well, which already were highlighting how different nature made some planetary systems from our own solar system. And it's just the sort of intrinsic human curiosity about what about planets like our own that sort of has driven us to keep developing the technology and astronomical methods to be able to find planets increasingly similar to the Earth.
We're going to take a quick break right now, and we'll be back with more of our program in a moment.
Jazz America.
This is Russ Davis, and on my program Jazz America, I carry on the tradition begun decades ago by the great Willis Conover by exploring the wonders of a century of jazz history. I'll cover it all, from Dixieland to swing to bebop to modal, free jazz, fusion, world jazz, contemporary, and beyond. Plus, you'll hear the words of the artists themselves as they tell their incredible stories. Join me for Jazz America, Saturdays and Sundays at 13 hours Universal Time, online at voanews.com and the Voice of America.
We're back with the science edition of Press Conference USA. Today, we're talking about the search for exoplanets, planets that are found beyond our solar system. My guest in this segment is Professor Eric Ford from Penn State University. Eric, my next question: once someone thinks they've found an exoplanet out in the cosmos, how do they go about getting their discovery noted and then confirmed?
It's not always simple. So in science, we're sort of by definition probing the limits of what we're capable of doing. And so sometimes you've built an instrument so powerful that you're able to really nail something, and one data set is just really compelling. And in that case, from one data set, you might get extra collaborators to help lend other areas of expertise, but you might be able to say, we're very confident that this planetary system observed by Kepler must be a planet, and we measure their masses and do a lot of detailed work from one data set. But more often, the objects you're finding, especially if you're looking for the smallest planets you're capable of finding, are sort of at the limits of what you can do, and so we want to bring in different types of observations. We might want to characterize the star's properties better so that we can determine what's the size of the planet more precisely and make sure we're not confusing a small planet around a small star with a big planet around a big star. In some cases, we may want to try to measure the planet's influence on a star in two different ways. So if we just see a star gets dimmer, you could ask questions like, well, are there other things that could cause a star to get dimmer? And so, for example, you might worry about something like maybe there's another star orbiting the star and just barely passing in front of just the little corner of the star's surface. And that might look like a planet to this transit method. But if that's the case, there are other observations we could take, such as measuring the colors of the star or measuring this Doppler shift, that would recognize that and distinguish between the planet case and the sort of grazing, eclipsing binary case. And so we try to think about not just what do we think it is, but what else could it be, and are there observations we could do that would help us distinguish between those different scenarios? And so that process of science where you never really know anything for sure, you're always testing and probing, and at some point you say, you know what, we've done so many tests in this object that it's 99.9% likely to be a planet, let's put this one on the table. And not everyone always has the same opinion of when something crosses that somewhat arbitrary line. So if you go to different websites, I just pulled up one really good one is exoplanets.org. It lists 16, 18 planets with good orbits listed in their exoplanet orbit database. But if you go to the NASA Exoplanet Archive, I'm looking and it says 1,905 confirmed planets, right? So sites maintained by scientists that treat things slightly differently, you have slightly different counts, right? Because there's always this matter of subjectivity. But at the end of the day, if you peered into any one of those stars and said, well, let's look at what's happening for this one. At the end of the day, even though the scientists may differ in how they classified in a binary sense, most of the time you'd find that each group could explain, well, there's these reasons to think it is a planet, these reasons we're still concerned there might be something else. And at the end of the day, it's kind of a judgment call. So there's often a gradual transition, and sometimes you need extra observations. Sometimes you just need more time to do the analysis more carefully. And sometimes you even have a case where different groups have come to different conclusions. So for the most part, science works, but it doesn't always work instantaneously. Oftentimes it takes a while to figure these things out and to reach the agreement that we all sort of seek as scientists trying to understand what nature really has out there for us to find.
Eric, I want to get back to something that you alluded to a few minutes ago. You know, astronomers have not only been able to discover and confirm exoplanets, but have been able to gain some valuable insight into its various aspects, such as its temperature or whether or not it has water or could be habitable. How are scientists able to gain so much information from an object so far away?
It feels like chemistry, you can do experiments, right? And you can control things. Astronomy is primarily an observational science. We have to observe what's out there in the universe, and we have limited capabilities. We can't manipulate a planet and see, does it become more or less habitable as we change its temperature or as its composition. So that's why we want to survey and find lots of planets around different types of stars at different stages of their lifetime so that we can begin to piece together these complicated questions of how common are potentially habitable planets. Fortunately, we have the laws of physics, and those laws of physics, just like Newton was able to recognize the apple falling from the tree and the moon orbiting the Earth had this underlying cause of gravity, we're able to apply chemistry and physics and photons and all that good science to be able to say, given what we know about this planet, what are reasonable inferences about that planet's either composition or the nature of its surface. So in some cases, we have some information like, the planet's so far from a star of a certain brightness, and we can work out, well, given what we know about how radiation works, what's the range of temperatures that planet could have? It could be absorbing all the starlight and just re-radiating the minimal amount back allowed by the laws of physics, or it could have lots of bright white clouds that reflect lots of starlight before it gets in to heat the surface. Sometimes we have a range of possibilities, and depending upon details that we don't yet know, like how big are the cloud coverage and what's the atmosphere made of, there's still considerable uncertainty in what the actual properties are. And that's why we often try to make sure we insert words like potentially habitable planets, because we don't actually know in really any cases yet beyond our solar system, but we can at least identify some that are unlikely to be habitable because, say, they're so close to their star that we can't think of a way to keep them cool enough to have liquid water on their surface.
Eric is with Penn State University's Center for Exoplanets and Habitable Worlds. Eric, thank you so much for taking the time to explain in very nice detail about exoplanets.
Happy to. Thanks for the opportunity.
You're listening to the Science Edition of Press Conference USA on the Voice of America. I'm your host, Rick Pantaleo. Today, we're talking about the search for extrasolar planets, especially those that might support life. Press Conference USA is available for free download on iTunes. You can find the download by clicking on the iTunes tab on our website at voanews.com/PCUSA. You may also connect with us on Facebook at Carol Castiel, VOA, or send us an old-fashioned email to PCUSA@voanews.com. Joining me in this segment is Lisa Kaltenegger, director of the Carl Sagan Institute and an associate professor of astronomy at Cornell University in Ithaca, New York. Lisa, I understand that more than 5,000 exoplanets have been discovered so far. Can you tell us about the furthest planet to be found so far?
The fascinating thing is that we're living in the time right now where we actually find other worlds. So think back when Columbus was getting on a ship and finding a new world, America at that point. But we're not just finding continents, we're finding completely new worlds. And some of them are, cosmologically speaking, right at our doorsteps. But what that means is still a really huge distance. Because if you have our sun and all the planets in our own solar system, so if you shrink them in your eye to the size of a cookie, and of course, I'm telling you this, so every time you eat a cookie, now you're thinking about astronomy. If you do that, then the next star, the stars you see up in the sky, are all stars, and they are other suns, so also they have planets. So the next star in that scale, where our whole solar system of all its planets is a cookie, is 2 football fields away. And the planets that we found are up to thousands or even more football fields away in this scale. And so the most fascinating for me are the closest ones. And the closest confirmed one that's at the right distance where it's not too hot and not too cold, so you could have water like on the Earth on the surface in liquid form, that's about 20 light years away, or about several tens of these soccer fields. And the really, really interesting thing is that the closest star to us, the one that I was saying is 2 football fields away, the closest star to us actually seems to wobble. That means it seems to be compensating for a planet that moves around it. So we haven't completely confirmed that there is a planet around even our closest star, but maybe there is. And small planets don't usually come alone. So the one that we think we found, has been in the news and will be confirmed later, that one is around the closest star, but very hot, very close to it. So it's incredibly hot on that planet. But small planets usually don't come alone. So if there's one small planet, we've learned that often there are other small planets. And so the excitement of looking at even our closest star that moves a little bit because it compensates the planet going around it is that maybe there's another one even further out in that region that we call the Goldilocks zone, after the story with the bears that eat this porridge. You know, one is too hot, one is too cold, one is just right. And so this Goldilocks zone, where it's just not too hot for liquid water, not too cold so it doesn't freeze out. And so we're hoping, and that is not confirmed at all, but we're hoping that maybe even around our closest star, there could be a planet in the Goldilocks zone. And the really important point is I talked about the scales. And so the closest star is in the scale where our solar system is a cookie, 2 football fields away. That's huge distances. And we are not very good at traveling yet, right? So we have the first satellite ever, 2012. It was called Voyager 1, left our own solar system, this cookie, and is now on its way to another star. But it's going to take hundreds of thousands of years. So close is really, really good. Because even if our transportation gets a little bit faster, what we very much hope, it's still going to be really far to travel for us.
You mentioned the Goldilocks zone or the habitable zone, and that makes me ask, here on Earth, oxygen and water are two of the components that support life, but that's life as we know it right now. What about more alien forms of life that would depend on other things to survive? Any evidence of this?
No evidence of that. So in our own solar system, we're actually looking at places that are very different from our own Earth. For example, we're looking at one of the moons of Saturn that's called Titan. And Titan is really, really cold. It's freezing. So water isn't liquid. But ethane or methane, these to other chemicals, they actually are liquid still at these really, really, really low temperatures. And the question is huge, but absolutely open, is whether life could use another liquid. And that's not even a huge step, right? Because you could envision, what about if life were completely different? But the interesting thing is, if you look around in the universe, carbon seems to be pretty much everywhere, and also hydrogen, that's like parts of the water, of course. So chances are that, according to my biology colleagues here, so I don't do that work, chances are that water, that life will actually be carbon-based, and then it will use a solvent like water, or at really cold temperatures, something like methane, ethane. But it's kind of limitless because we do not know what life could do under very, very different conditions when it's really cold or really hot, because we only have life as we know it on the Earth. So that's the only thing we can look at and try to find, because we know what kind of signatures it leaves in an atmosphere, basically what it breathes in and what it breathes out. Because these planets that go around other stars, around other suns, so they don't orbit our own sun, they orbit another one, those are so far away that we can't send a satellite there or a rover that goes and has a look at the surface or at microbes. The only thing we have is we can look at the air of that planet, because light travels from it through the universe and we can catch it with our telescopes. And so if we catch the light from another planet, we can have a look at that light and at its air, what's in the air of that planet. And then we'll have to look for things that life produces as we know it, unfortunately. We'd love to look for things that life produces as we don't know it, but there's the problem, of course. Life as we don't know it produces signatures as we don't know it. So what we do is we keep our eyes open for surprises, for things that we can't explain. But our search strategy is looking for life as we know it, and then hopefully there's going to be a lot of surprises that come with it.
You mentioned your colleague, your biologist colleague, and that made me curious about your institution, the Carl Sagan Institute. I understand that the Institute performs multidisciplinary research to explore planets and planetary systems. Now, what disciplines are we talking about? Normally, when you're talking about looking for and discovering exoplanets, think about astronomy. What other disciplines are involved, and how are these different forms of science being used in this search for exoplanets and possible life?
Just the question that you have before, what about different forms of life, right? That just shows you that this quest or this looking for life in the universe, it will be performed by astronomers insofar that we use the telescope and we look and we understand the stars. But this whole puzzle of what life could be and how it could look like, that needs a lot of people from different disciplines, like biologists, chemists. We also need the engineers that actually tell us what we can detect and what we can't, or that build the instruments for us, and people who study the Earth in really big detail, because, of course, we want to use everything we know about the Earth and the planetary system that we have to understand how signatures of life could change. And so the Carl Sagan Institute here at Cornell was just founded in May, but it basically has this idea as its core to look at this interdisciplinary, to bring all the people with really good ideas into one room to talk to each other, because at such fundamental questions like, is there life in the universe and can we find it? And on the other hand, what will happen to our planet in the future? Because if we see older Earths out there, we can also address that question. What can potentially happen to us? What will potentially happen to us? To answer that question, you need input from so many different disciplines. And this is why it's so exciting to have the Carl Sagan Institute here at Cornell, because right now we have 22 faculty from all over the campus. So that means biologists, chemists, atmospheric scientists, engineers, astronomers, I think we don't have architects yet. I do have to say they have to work on this. But all of this is basically together. We're meeting once a month for a kind of informal coffee to talk about our ideas and bring together this third strategy for life in the universe and trying to figure out what's going to happen to our own planet and how we put it into context.
Most of the research that's being conducted today in searching for exoplanets, from what I understand, the Kepler spacecraft is very valuable. What are some of the other tools that are being used by the Carl Sagan Institute and, of course, those from the other disciplines?
So basically what we're doing is like, if we start with the astronomy, so what we're doing is we're actually generating a database of light fingerprints from other planets. And what that is really using a model like the one that you use for the Earth if it's going to rain tomorrow or, you know, next week. So weather forecast or just understanding how the air will change on the Earth. But we use it for many, many different planets in our own solar system. You know, there we have data as well, so we can compare. And then to explore how they would change if the Earth were more heavy, were more massive, if it were lighter, it were hotter, it were colder. And so we're using computers as a tool to understand or to figure out what we could see with a telescope. How long will we have to look for a smaller Earth to not miss signatures of life, for example? And then if you just go over, it's not very far, to the engineering department, they're looking at all the telescopes that are coming online and see which instruments they can build to actually find exactly those signatures that we predict. And also they tell us what capability is going to come online. So we refine basically what we'd be able to see. And then you go to the biologist and they say, well, you know, if it's cold or if it's colder, so how could life now start to be different? What kind of signatures would that, again, actually leave in an atmosphere or at a surface? Because even if you look at our own planet, there's, if you go to Yellowstone, there are beautiful colors in this national park. And those beautiful colors are actually biological systems. That's biota that makes these beautiful colors because it lives in hotter, colder environments. And so one of the questions, for example, that we did, and that's one of the first publications that came out of the Carl Sagan Institute, is a life color catalog, where we said, well, let's have an inventory on life as we know it, even if it's extreme, it's not the one that you usually think of. What color would it have? And then translate that into if you had a telescope that looked at a planet that were just a little bit different and therefore the perfect place for such extremophiles or life that lives under very different conditions than ours, how would that look like? Could we spot the difference just by the light that we collect? And so this is basically how all these different disciplines actually work together and form, I think, a very different center here at Cornell. And this is also why, for me personally, it's so much fun to work here because I'm learning something new every day. And really, at the core, that's what scientists love to do.
And finally, Lisa, what are some of the current or future projects at the Carl Sagan Institute that you find most interesting?
But we just ended up in engineering. So one of the really fun engineering projects that just working on right now is, you know, this small frozen moons. There's one that's called Europa. It's going around Jupiter. But the question is if under this frozen surface, so we know there's an ocean, but could there be life? And the engineering department right now is just working on something like a robotic eel, you know, that fish that goes up and down, that could swim in such an ocean and take measurements. How would you build it? How would you bring it there, for example? Or here in the astronomy department, what we're looking at, for example, for these exoplanets now is, you know, the stars, we know that how our sun was born and will die because we look at other suns and we look how old they are and we look how they look like. And so even so we live a little tiny amount of the time that our own star, the sun, lives. We know how it was born and how it will die. But by the same token, we know that the star brightens through time. So we know that it will get actually too hot here on the Earth in about 1 billion years, so we have a little bit of time. But then we will not be in this Goldilocks zone, in this habitable zone anymore, and all the water on the Earth will evaporate. But now if we look at other stars and we find planets around them, we have to figure out how old are they? Where is this perfect distance, this Goldilocks zone for those? Because it's kind of really important to figure out how old they are and then figure out how long a planet could have been habitable and what signatures for life you'd look for. And so this is just some tiny snippets and things. I think I could go on and on going through the departments, but this is just some of the fun things that we're working on.
Lisa, thank you so much for taking time to talk with me today.
Thank you for having me.
That was Lisa Kaltenegger, director of the Carl Sagan Institute and an associate professor of astronomy at Cornell University in Ithaca, New York. And I'm afraid that's all the time we have on this science edition of Press Conference USA. I'm Rick Pantaleo. Join us again next week for another Press Conference USA on the Voice of America.